Well, thank you very much for having me here on this Mother's Day, and I wanted to say it's a great pleasure to be here, especially because my mother is visiting from Colorado, and my father as well, and my wife is around here somewhere, maybe downstairs with my two children who are also here today. And when I asked John to describe your congregation for me, the first word that came to his mind was raucous. He later recanted it, but I think I'll stick with that description. So, today I'm really also thrilled to be able to share with you some thoughts on some questions that I've pondered for many years. And those questions are, what is religion? What does religion connect us to? And why does it matter? Got 20 minutes to do that. But sermons are supposed to be for looking at big questions, are they not? And if we don't look at big questions, what I think happens is that we as individuals and societies get stuck in ruts, big, huge, unhealthy ruts, and or we don't even know that we're in a rut and can't get out. So when we know that things are amiss but we're not quite sure why, it's time to ask those big questions. So here we go. The first one was, what is religion? And I don't think this question gets asked directly very often. We characterize it, but we don't say, what is religion? So to shake things up a little bit, I start with the work of one Emo Phillips. And Emo is a strange sort of fellow, and he has a strange voice that I'm not going to try to imitate, but he said when someone asked him if he was religious, he said, well, if by religious you mean that I go to church every Sunday and I tithe and things like that, no, I'm not religious. But if you mean by religious, I'm basically a good person and I follow the golden rule, again, no. But but if by religious you mean that I really like coleslaw, then yes, I'm very, very religious. Now, I don't know about the coleslaw part, but it does seem that when we do bother to ask that question, what is religion, We don't even know what we mean by the question. We equate religion with following the golden rule or attendance at a religious institution, and those are good and needed, but it doesn't really tell us what religion is. So I'd like to dig a little deeper. Let's think back to a time when the question, what is religion, could first be even considered, at a time when we as human beings could even ask a question. That was perhaps tens or even hundreds of thousands of years ago, at a time when we had evolved an awareness of time, an awareness of self that would go so far to know that we ourselves were going to die. Before that time, we couldn't really entertain the question to begin with, but after those things came into our mental capacity, two questions would have come screaming to the forefront. Why are we here, or where did we come from, and what is going to happen to us after we die? And it seems like most religions of the world deal with those questions, but inherent in those questions, and I think transcending them altogether, is another one. How do we relink these newfound awarenesses, our new mind, back to that which it sprung from, all of nature around and within us? I think when it comes right down to it, that's what religion is. In fact, the religion comes from Latin religio, which means relink. And so what are we relinking to? We might answer in a quick way, to God or to something larger or to the life force. But it probably began with a sense of wanting to relink or wondering how we relink to the raw forces and rhythms of nature around us. So let's examine that second question a little more closely. What was it that our ancestors were trying to relink to, and what might we relink to today? Well, Unitarians refer to the interconnected web of life, and that's a good phrase. And a phrase that I use for nature often is, at least as we experience it here on Earth, is a single interconnected system of life. And a word that's captured that lately is Gaia. Gaia is a metaphor for the scientific idea of Earth as a single living system, and it was suggested for the scientific idea by William Golding, who wrote The Lord of the Flies, to capture the power and the history behind that realization. So in a way, we're trying to reconnect to nature around us. But even here, we can get into the weeds of abstraction pretty quickly. In modern society, we don't tend to experience the elements and nature in as direct a way as our ancestors did. And so we really need to shake up our assumptions again. So yes, I'm going to turn to Emo Phillips once again. And he said that when he was a little boy, his father told him, "Emo, never ever open the cellar door." And Emo didn't. He was a very obedient child. But as years went by, he was more and more curious, of course. And so one day he couldn't help himself. He went over and he ripped open the cellar door. And there behind it were weird and wonderful things that he'd never seen before, like grass and trees and the sun. Our view of nature, I'm afraid, is a bit like poor Emo's situation. Great truths and insights are on the other sides of cellar doors that we either create for ourselves or that we inherited, that were created for us. And so sometimes we flounder in ruts, not even knowing that we are in a rut. Somewhat like Emo not even realizing that where he was. Let me give you an example. Centuries ago, people thought that the air around them was divine, that it was holy, that it was spiritual, all those words that we kind of throw in there together. Every breath you took was taking in the spirit, and how would it seem otherwise to them, because they didn't know what it was? There's no color, you can't taste it, and yet if you don't do that, you die. So we thought of the air as being the spirit, and in fact the Chinese word qi is energy or air or spirit all in one. And in our own etymology, we inspire, we take in the spirit. And if we die, we expire, and when we breathe, we respire. But we don't recall that very much because it's become so scientific and explained to us. Well, how did that happen? Well, it turns out that our very own Joseph Priestley was a Unitarian minister, also a scientist, and I think we're in the Joseph Priestley district here. And he's credited with first finding what oxygen was over 200 years ago. And so he saw that it was the component of air that allowed animals to stay alive. And since then, of course, we've explained it in great detail. What is this molecule and what is that molecule and what percentage and so forth. So in a way, the spirituality, the mystery, the wonder and awe of it has disappeared. And we rarely think about that except for on some nice morning when we go out and take a breath and feel good about it. Well, I use this story of oxygen as an example of how we in modern society are starting to rediscover what Gaia is. The larger idea of Gaia is still, I think, behind that cellar door, but every once in a while the cellar door is flapping open in a little windstorms of enlightenment, and it reveals a fantastic new world to us. It's a world in which oxygen itself is kept at 21% all the time for at least a couple hundred million years due to or in spite of or as part of this interaction between us breathing in, plants breathing it out, and it being consumed in great gulps and forest fires and rusting things, oxidizing things. Despite all those things happening all the time, it's there at 21%. To me, that's as kind of awe-inspiring and spine-tingling as maybe my ancestors thinking of the air around them as being animate and alive. But it's much more than that. It's also a planet where life preserves its own water. It's not just that we're a water planet, we're so lucky to be here, and without water we couldn't have life. It's almost the other way around, that by now, if it weren't for life, we wouldn't have any water. All the water would have boiled off our planet. Or that the temperature would have been as high as 290 degrees, what you would calculate right between Mars and Venus, if it weren't for the fact that life was greatly moderating life on Earth. But as amazing as all these discoveries are, to me the most spine-tingling realization about this living system that we're rediscovering has to do with my ability to have that realization. That is to say, I'm now aware that our minds are also a seamless part of the earth around us, not just our bodies. Think about it. An alien watching life unfold on earth would have seen the evolution of our kind and not thinking, having any reason to think that our minds should be different than our behavior, should be different than our biology, would have seen that what is happening on earth now, the tremendous impact we have, is a result of this behavior of this creature which stems from our mind. And so I think that this is one of the biggest rediscoveries, the rediscovery of the simple truth that our minds sprung from Gaia. Like Emo must have when he discovered the outside world, that's what gives me the biggest shivers. So why does this matter? That was my third question. And I think that a view of religion or a worldview in which we recognize that our minds sprung from Earth is extremely helpful, if not perhaps necessary, for our search for ways of living long-term on this planet. When we acquired the ability to abstract and to sense the future, including our own deaths, our minds did and do go racing off on tremendous tangents to the circle of life, and we go faster and faster, and with a sense of ultimate purpose and power that we do not have. Ultimately, this leads to exhaustion. It leads to exhaustion of our minds, it leads to exhaustion of our societies, of our resources. If we can't relink our minds to the ways that nature as a whole works, especially the rhythms of nature, then we're always going to be swimming upstream in this endeavor with the possibility of being prone to collapse at any moment. To a certain extent, this idea of our minds being part of nature is not an entirely new insight. People have been urging thinking green for many decades now, and Earth system science is indeed guiding our actions to a certain extent. But I think that this additional layer of insight, that our minds themselves are a seamless continuum of life around us, may be the missing link. That is, that which can't be overstated in its importance, because it's not known yet by all of us how important it is. I suggest this in the same spirit as Elizabeth Sartoris introduced her book entitled Gaia, the Human Journey from Chaos to Cosmos. And she writes in that introduction, she calls it a work of philosophy in the original sense of a search for wisdom, for practical guidance in human affairs through understanding the natural order of the cosmos to which we belong. Towards the end of that book, which, by the way, can be printed off online free now under the book called Earth Dance, she writes, "Once we truly grasp the scientific reality of the Gaian organism and its physiology, our entire worldview and practices are bound to change profoundly, revealing the way to solving what now appear to be some of our most insoluble problems." And I wholeheartedly agree with that assessment, but I would just simply add that our worldview itself is part of the Gaian organism. And knowing Elizabeth Sartoris, I believe she'd concur with this. My friend in Arlington, Larry Robertson, just recently wrote a book called A Deliberate Pause, subtitled Entrepreneurship and Its Moment in Human Progress. He sees entrepreneurship not as some business venture to make a quick buck, but as the creative spirit of human beings, what we bring to the world to make a better place. And one of the people that he interviewed in his book, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus, believes that entrepreneurship is in every human being and in everything human. Again, I agree completely, and I think that this is the biggest gains will come when we blend this notion of entrepreneurship as innate creativity with the idea that our creativity is innately of the earth. One last thought on this. I've come to the conclusion that one of our most severe limitations to being able to arrive at a sustainable solutions for our society is not technology or organization, as important as those are, but simply our ability to communicate clearly, honestly, and proactively with each other. So much of the search for any set of solutions is hidden or obfuscated or made ineffective because of our inability or unwillingness to communicate in an effective and honest and open manner. But what if we were to see even this as part of the life of our planet? What if how we communicated with and conducted our relationships with each other, with groups, with nations, could be seen as part of the larger conscience of Earth? As a child, my sense of conscientiousness, in effect, what compelled me to communicate honestly and proactively, was buttressed by an internalized sense that there was a God that knew all my thoughts, and if that was true, I couldn't very well consciously deceive someone, because if I did, who knows what might happen. But as an adult, that sense of an omnipotent power knowing my every thought and then chastising me if I communicate dishonestly is difficult to imagine. But I do think that our thoughts and therefore our actions have a profound effect on the world. So there's something there. How we think and thus act affects our close circles of family and friends. It affects our communities. It affects our world. And ultimately, I believe, our ability to survive and thrive on Earth. And if you think, how could it be otherwise? Our thoughts determine our directions. So in effect, a larger power does know our thoughts, and it does act as the buttress to our innate sense of conscientiousness. Where our ancestors might have known this in a mythological way, we can now add to that reason and science in understanding that that is the case. So as we mull over these ideas, I'll draw to a close with a poem by William Stafford entitled "A Ritual to Read to Each Other." And I've taken poetic license and added one probably obvious line. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, and we don't know the kind of planet we're a part of, a pattern made by others may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood storming out through the broken dike. As elephants parade holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the heart of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not to recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life gets lost in the dark. For it's important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes, no, maybe, should be clear, for the darkness around us is deep. So the darkness around us is deep indeed, but so is the light. And on this Mother's Day, I suggest that our ability to go to the light may come when we venture beyond that cellar door and relink our minds with the rest of nature around us. It's not an onerous task, but one of joyful rediscovery, of discovering the grass and the trees and the sun. On this Mother's Day, we can remember our ancestral sense of Earth as a living being, and combine that with our scientific understanding of the same thing. We can rediscover a sense of spirituality and mystery in the material world, and we can work with a sense of responsibility and spirituality and creativity born of a new perspective, that of seeing our minds as a seamless continuum of this beautiful, living, blue-green planet powered by the sun and all spinning through space. Thank you.